Hello and welcome to the next episode of the It Depends podcast. I am Daniel Pritchett here with Jesse Brown.
Hello again.
Brian Langford.
Hello, good to be here.
And Mo Mohundro.
How's it going?
Today's episode is going to be a response to a listener reaching out on Twitter at Clear Function. We've got at Jimmy Turner PT who asks, as a second year .NET dev, do y'all have tips or strategy on how to hit the ground running inside a large and unfamiliar code base?
That's a very good question.
Yes. I think the key for me is going to be second year .NET dev. I mean, the work is common to us, but remembering what's appropriate and useful and actionable for someone with that background. So who wants to go first?
So the first question to ask is, what resources do you have?
Mm-hmm.
So don't spend a lot of time on trying to go through the code if you already have a subject matter expert, someone who knows the code. They're going to be the best resource. So some of the projects we've been on where we come in and it's, you know, 5-10-year-old code base, we could spend a week going through that, or we could spend an hour with someone who knows what they're doing, and we'll know drastically more than we would had we spent that week on it.
Yeah, getting the 30,000-foot view of what you're looking at is super useful. And if you've got people on hand to tell you, oh, this part of the system does X, and it's better than just trying to figure out what is, you know, just line by line trying to figure out what this does. You don't need to understand every line of code. You know, that's not what you're after. You just need to know what the business is doing, what does this application give the business, and what's the input and output sort of.
So even just not even necessarily the technical understanding of the technical architecture of everything, just understanding an overarching idea of what the actual application's doing from breaking up the app into pieces.
And because if you don't even know that, then code's really hard to look at. Right. You start making your own assumptions and building on those assumptions, and then it all gets broken by one line of code you see that means that whatever you thought up until that point is now invalid. If you don't know what it is that it's actually doing, it's very hard to build on that and level up your understanding instead of just constantly having to go back to ground zero and figuring out what it is actually doing. So having someone to tell you, hey, this goal of this code is to do this, that gives you a nice, firm standing.
Important thing for me is to look at the parameters of the engagement. So for us, it's usually going to be a consulting job. We're brought in for some limited amount of time as a development team to work on somebody else's code base, and often we'll be maybe more up-to-date on the latest practices in this particular language or platform than some of the in-house staff. And so we got to figure out who on the current in-house team knows the most about this, how can we befriend them and work together to succeed. But maybe Jimmy is joining an in-house team and is just a junior member on a team with two or three people who are owning a particular piece of software that might be several years old and have decades more to go.
Something with that too is knowing how much of the code you actually need to worry about. There's something even for teams that have been around for a while, if they avoid a certain part of the system, it might mean that it's a good thing to learn something about, but it also could be a sign that that part just always works.
Right.
So you can sort of almost treat it this is the framework. You don't need to learn everything there. This is just a component that works all the time, and you're good. Just knowing to not dive down into parts of the system that you don't need to.
It's especially important, like you're talking about, when you're consulting, is figuring out those people to talk to, because those people will usually be the gateway to documentation.
Absolutely.
Because that's usually what I find. If you get dropped in, you just start digging around and someone tells you kind of the high level what the app does. But if that person's not a technical person, if there are other technical people on there on the team that you could talk to, a lot of times they'll be like, oh yeah, we have a wiki somewhere with some random login that no one set you up with because HR has no idea that this even exists. And so knowing that that's where you're going to find your diagrams that tell you the order of operations of this code and the database schema and how it all relates and all that stuff that isn't actually in source code, and maybe it isn't source code. That's definitely one of the first things you could check for. If there's a README or documentation in the source repository itself, that's a good place to start.
But I almost wonder if that's even a better place to start than some other type of documentation. I don't know. I've just found in the past that usually documentation is so outdated. I mean, it's outdated within the next, 5 minutes after it was written sometimes, with software in general. But I don't know if y'all's experience has been like that before with documentation coming into a code base and having documentation. How good has that been for you guys, like maybe in the past?
You know the answer. It depends. Right. But I have found that there's often when you come into a project, or if I'm remembering distinctly a time whenever I was actually the person who knew the code base, mm-hmm. someone else was coming to me, and they knew there was documentation. But I was like, oh, yeah, there's actually more documentation than that. So it's sort of just knowing even where to go. Right, because right. teams will, especially for a long-running project, like you might have documentation that's in the repo. You might have documentation that's in a wiki. I think most people are, especially for something that they've worked on a long time, they'll have notes. Mm-hmm. But they might not be shared well. Mm-hmm. You know, you might even have something where it's like they've got like a binder at their desk, you know,
right.
And it just totally depends on the type of project you're coming into and things like that. And
yeah,
it's hard to say for sure. Mm-hmm. There's other ones that I've seen where there's literally no documentation.
Right.
Yeah. To Brian's point, the best documentation in my experience has been the source code control itself. You know, a lot of times what I like to do is find an entry point in the application that you're looking at. If it's a website, you go find, you know, a web controller or something like that. You're like, oh yeah, there's clearly the home page. Like, what renders the home page? Just trying right. to get us started something
easy,
and then figuring out, okay, here's the main function of kind of what this app's supposed to do. Once you've learned that, and then going to where you think some core logic is that you'd like to understand a little better. And then I usually look at the history of that one file and find and like open up some diffs when there were some bug fixes going on. I don't try to go to like the initial creation and try to understand some, you know, the initial like point of this particular file, but looking at that file and being like, oh, look, here's where they made, you know, they trimmed the string for some reason, right? It'll usually have some, you know, a Jira case or Fogbugs case or something that it's linked to. And then you can maybe jump over there and figure out why they needed to trim that string suddenly. But also just looking at which parts of the system are updated frequently versus infrequently. It goes back to kind of what Mo was talking about earlier, as far as maybe I don't need to learn so much about this really complicated bit because it's mm-hmm. always worked for the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. Like, it's been updated 3 times in 10 years. Like, maybe you don't have to worry about it too much. But if there's this, you know, hot spots, then you can kind of figure out the history of it and why it's changing and how hard does it look to change something, so that when someone comes to ask you, you know, it's likely going to be in that sort of hot spot area. Right. And yeah, just know the effort and like what's going on with that.
One other thing too, good documentation for code is any tests. There's no guarantee that they will be there if the code has been there for too long. Mm-hmm. Automated unit tests are, you know, in the grand scheme of development.
Invent. Yeah.
I mean, you know, like JUnit came out, what, in the maybe 10 to 15 years ago, but there are code bases out there that are older. And mm-hmm. so, but if you have tests, they are a great resource, especially if they all pass.
only if they pass.
But that way you can sort of see the intent of the code, and you can have the, you know, so that's a good way you can sort of play with a test, maybe change it, get it to fail. It just is a good way to sort of see. It also will communicate, or hopefully will communicate, what parts of the system are important enough to have tests for.
You guys mentioned documentation. I know we talked a bit about finding people who know things about the system to help you out. One thing that I try to be aware of is the project or the system's overall goals and how that matches with the people involved. Because I've seen situations, especially in big enterprise projects, where not everybody in the company is rooting for the project to succeed. And it's not that they're bad people. They may have competing incentives or competing projects. Like, maybe if your project succeeds, and that could lead to their department automating a bunch of stuff and one of their favorite people or themselves having reduced responsibilities, which can make them nervous. So think about that. It certainly helps to go find the people on the front lines who are using the system, but realize that they may not have right. the same goals that you do, short term or long term.
Or there's some projects where it's like you can, there's more leeway in terms of like, hey, is it okay if this thing changes right. or not?
You know? And maybe, you know, like Jesse was saying, just getting into, you know, if they got, hopefully they have source control history. And if you can get right. if you can get in there, it could be kind of telling. Like, you could see like, oh wow, like they've made a lot of commits towards these right. few files. Mm-hmm. what is it about? Like, it might be kind of telling as to the nature of the app and how, mm-hmm. you know, maybe this is a tough spot. Maybe mm-hmm. this is, but, you know, it might be just interesting to kind of know that going in, like, these are some of the harder areas that apparently we've had issues with, that
yeah.
you, just having that knowledge beforehand.
Right. Might be right.
And I think, since we mentioned it, yeah, it's nice if you have source control. If it doesn't, that should be probably your number one thing, is right. getting in source control.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. And number two is test. You know, if there is a core part of the system that you are very afraid of breaking that the business relies on, the first thing you should probably try to focus on is getting some sort of test around that core functionality
right.
To prove that it works, so that when you're in there messing with it, you can prove that it still works the way it used to right. the best of your ability, if mm-hmm. possible. This is not always possible. There's a lot of work involved to bring in the first test in. But you know, it should be one of your goals if you can do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing even maybe before that is running it locally.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah, there's a lot of systems that live only in production.
Yeah.
Even
yeah.
in .NET. I know right. this is about .NET, which is a relatively recent platform in the grand scheme of things. But there's still, I've been on numerous projects where you're like, oh yeah, I need to update to my .NET site, and then you're like, all right, where's the source? And they just give you an FTP location.
Yeah.
Right.
And you're like, oh. I've had to right. actually use a tool that like reflects the compiled C# code back out to C# and like redo all the variables from a site where just, you know, some contractor somewhere deployed it to FTP, never gave them the source.
Right.
And,
oh, goodness. Wow.
Yeah. And so it happens. And so that if you're in that situation, I feel for you, but, mm-hmm. But the best you can do is try to get the source code back out and, get to a compiling state and, redeploy.
The benefit with having it running locally too, and when I say that, I mean all components, like database included. That way you have a sandbox where you can do whatever you want to do, and you can break it, you can refix it. It's just, once you have it running locally, then you can also do things like, hey, say for example, it's a web application. You pull up the browser, you go to it. You can start working your way from the outside in and sort of say, okay, so this URL maps to this thing. It's just maybe being aware of how you learn and how best mm-hmm. to wrap your head around things. But I tend to want to browse through it, and I want to get, like, maybe you're looking at, you know, you've got 20 controllers or something, and you don't, where does it start?
Yeah,
you know, how many of these things are behind a login? How many of these things are public? How many of these things are APIs? Just open up if you can get it running locally, then you can.
And part of getting it running locally, you know, if it's not made to run locally, as far as like the, you know, the repository doesn't kind of give you instructions on how to do it, and there's prod connection strings, you know, in the configs or something like that, you know, that should be. Yeah, that's a good thing to look for first, is make sure you're not going to be connecting to prod, because the last thing you want to do is like accidentally run migrations or reseed production data or something insane like right. that. So you want to, yeah. and if there isn't a way to reliably create a database, you probably want to secure a backup of production and mm-hmm. restore it locally, and then change all the connection strings in the repo to point locally. And you know, this is stuff that takes time, and it's not the fun type of programming, but it needs to be done, and you need to have a database that runs locally, or at least in a development like environment. You don't want to be updating production on accident.
It sounds like you want to yank the network cord before you try your dev app.
I was just thinking that, like, if you're not sure.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea. Yeah,
don't
just turn off your Wi-Fi.
Run is there any experience
connection issues? You know what happened.
Has this happened to any of y'all?
Accidentally updating production?
Yeah.
Sounds familiar, but I can't. Let's hear yours, Jesse.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I want to say, I don't know how long ago it was. A couple years, I'll say. And I guess it was a migration sort of issue where someone had left their connection string into dev, and I was just developing locally. So, well, someone had committed it. So it wasn't it was supposed to be pointed at local. Someone committed it. You know, you merge master and you run, and then suddenly like everyone's broken in dev because it's got all these tables I was messing with mm-hmm. locally. I'm like, oh, why did, what happened? You know, so it wasn't like directly my fault, but like if this was production, and a lot of times people, this is my pet peeve, rename your databases completely different in each environment. Like a lot of people will be like, my project database, and it'll be the same in dev, staging, and production.
Yeah.
And the only thing that's different is like the IP address it maps to or something like that.
Hmm.
And so if you don't require a VPN or something, let's say it's a public database, or maybe it's inside the network, you know, mm-hmm. Just by you being able to access it through your like Windows authentication, you can just connect straight to prod and start running migrations because you didn't realize it, right?
Yeah.
So be careful.
I've had situations like that where I've run code locally and it was pointed to production. And so I'm in there and I'm debugging and I'm changing data. And then I have, for example, SSMS up and it's not showing changes. So then I spend a few more minutes trying to figure out what's going on, mm-hmm. and I'm still not seeing it. And then that wave of dread sort of hits. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah. Wait a second. What is going on? And that's when you realize, oh no, I have been changing production. So it's like, yeah, it's something to worry about.
I'd also say maybe, you know, as you get into something new that, you know, unfamiliar territory and things like that, make notes because mm-hmm. You could help out the next guy, right?
Your next coworker,
mm-hmm. right? And that's invaluable, you know.
Absolutely.
And I think the company would appreciate it too. I didn't realize we had to have source control. Yes, it's a good thing to have. Let's get that set up and get that going. So it goes a long way towards being more productive.
If you're new to a project, you're uniquely valuable in that capacity. You'll have to ask people who already know the project how these things are done, and maybe they'll send you an email or just explain it at your desk. But if you can turn around and write that down and put it in a wiki or something, then that's great for the next person. I know I went through that this week with a different project where I got stuck on something and Jesse went and figured it out, and now I've typed it up. I can't take any credit for figuring it out, but at least nobody else will have to.
It's sort of the Boy Scout rule, you know, leave it better than you left than you when you came. It's treat documentation the same way. If it's not clear to you, then chances are good that it won't be clear to someone else.
Right.
Yeah.
So I've heard you all talking about making your own documentation, setting up a dev server, running unit tests, and to me all that speaks to setting yourself up to be able to safely experiment, to learn mm-hmm. the system and teach yourself things.
Yep.
And I definitely agree there. Just get in the lab and put on your lab coat and your goggles and start starting fires and breaking things and seeing what happens. And that's really the only way I know to start to get a feel for a system.
Are there any tools that you use that maybe help you navigate a system? Like, I'm thinking things like, you know, whether it's finding files or I'm a
Resharper.
Fan of...
Yeah, Resharper. Yeah.
Resharper, for sure. You know, but even, like, something I'll do is before I ever open Visual Studio sometimes, or if someone is asking, like, I'm curious if there's log, I'll do a text search for mm-hmm. log.
Yeah.
You know, just see how many things are in there. Mm. So whether that's tools like Silver Searcher or grep or Platinum Searcher or whatever, mm-hmm. I will often use some of those searches outside of even Visual Studio just because once I'm familiar with sort of the file structure, then it gives me sort of somewhere to look once I'm in Visual Studio too. Mm-hmm. So
I have less .NET experience than you guys, so I just want to emphasize the point that you all said Resharper and smiled and nodded at each other as if that goes without saying. So just for Jimmy out there, all of these people are just assuming Resharper goes without saying. So anybody who's new to .NET and maybe is not in a shop where everybody else thinks they really should have it, at least try the download and just see what you can get out of it for a few months.
To go a little further in terms of some of the things that it will give you, you can do things like quick shortcuts to jump to definition. You can find usages. You can do quick refactorings. Side tangent for future. Stuff, but I mean, refactoring code can help a lot in terms of learning how stuff works mm-hmm. too, because you're sort of changing it and experimenting with it. But
That's something I like to do with confusing code is, again, you don't want to break something that works in production, but if you see a module and you can't quite understand it, just start pushing things around and mm-hmm. renaming things and rearranging things until it starts to make sense or it blows up, one or the other, and then hopefully you learn something.
Especially like poorly named variables or methods, you know? That goes back to leaving it better than when you came in, mm-hmm. but that helps immensely in terms of learning what's going on, too.
Right.
Some people I know will like to visualize code. So whether that's diagrams or something like that,
right.
I don't personally get a lot from that. I get benefit from having someone who already knows the code whiteboard some of the stuff with me, or those sort of diagrams.
Mm-hmm. Schema diagrams.
Diagrams
for SQL
yeah.
Server or whatever. Already.
Yeah, yeah, I do yeah. like those.
That's a good point. I don't think we've explicitly gone there, but
yeah.
most of the programs I've worked on are a web app that are backed by a single mm-hmm. database
Absolutely.
That has a schema. Spend some time looking at all the tables
Absolutely.
And all the fields.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so that's definitely a tool. ReSharper, we use like, you know, SQL Server, if you're using SQL Server to do the, they'll usually auto-generate the diagrams for you for the database if you don't already have some mm-hmm. from the company. Yeah, I was trying to think of what else. I mean, there's, like I said, the searching, like using Silver Searcher, things like that.
Maybe look for config files, if any, figure out
yeah.
what kinds there are, where they are, what's
yeah,
in there.
Yeah, that usually expose a lot of complexity. Like if you've got like 300 app settings, then you know like, okay, this is going to take a while to figure out how to boot this up like production. Because you probably mm-hmm. want to go start
right.
pulling them from production and make sure that, or at least start looking at them mm-hmm. and figuring out which knobs are actually on in production. You know, if they've got just a bunch of settings, like, you know, feature flippers, you know, like being turning on and off features. A lot of times people put those in app settings or in the database even, you know. And so just knowing, you know, trying to find something that looks settings-like is a good idea to try to figure out what is configurable.
One thing that's important to know, especially when you get in there and start making code or writing code, is if this is a large code base, it's probably had multiple people working on it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there may even be some parts of the system that are, shall we say, better than other parts of the system. So you want to follow the conventions. Hopefully the code base already has some conventions. But if there's multiple, like some code bases, you can tell who wrote it based on how it was written.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, finding the part of the system that's the best so that you can follow those patterns. Because, you know, especially when you step into an unfamiliar code base, you want to follow what's already there, but if you follow the part of the system that they've been trying to move away from, you know, then you're suddenly duplicating, and it's just like you actually may have made it worse.
Right.
It's hard to know some of those things without someone who you can ask, but...
Right. Yeah. I think that just goes back to, you know, finding that person that you can maybe pair with that's maybe more senior or, you know, that's been there a while, understands the code base. You know, discovering from them what are the conventions you guys are wanting to move towards so that I can go towards that way, you know, that direction if I run into some stuff that doesn't look
it
or whatever.
I'm thinking about, you know, like large .NET code base.
Mm-hmm.
If it's been around for any amount of time, I wouldn't be at all surprised to find things like Classic ASP in there.
Mm-hmm.
You might find some COM. You might find some web forms. You probably find some MVC. And even just talking MVC, you might have some straight razor. You might have some single page applications talking to it, which then you have, you know, five or six different options. The .NET world Knockout was really popular for a period of time. You're going to find Angular. I mean, just knowing which approach is best if you're working on, especially if it's new feature development.
Yeah.
Yeah, along the same lines of like ReSharper, there's code coverage tools. If there are tests, a lot of you know, you can run those tools to figure out how much of the code is covered, so that you don't really have regressions or major regressions in code coverage, and and to kind of let you know the you know, the places of the system that are well tested, so that you can continue that trend and keep upping that number as you see fit, and kind of not necessarily code related, but one of the things I like to do if you're sort of in an IT role. So let's say you rolled onto a shop and you're the developer, but you're also sort of the IT for the actual deployment. You're going to want to install something, you know, in the cloud like New Relic or other APM monitoring solutions. And that's usually one of the first things I like to do in a new project that I've sort of, you know, inherited for some reason. And it doesn't have any of those tools, is turn those on, like even before you do anything, because it's really important to know the baseline of what you had. And then, you know, you'll start to see hotspots where, you know, these queries are taking 20 seconds to come back, or there's, you know, there's 100, 500 errors happening a day. And so that gives you some, like, you know, things to drive forward on. You know, you're like, okay, I've got, you know, we're only doing so many requests a second, and so many of those are failing. So you can start plugging away at those numbers and getting some insight of, like, which pages are producing errors. Same thing with, like, Sentry. Sentry's another one. It's less of an APM, but it's more like, you know, one of your first changes should be like getting a centralized logging of some sort in if it doesn't already have one. Either find the one that's there or try to get one in place so that you can have some visibility into an unfamiliar system.
Right. And like you said, it kind of gives you that baseline because the day that you commit your first set of changes, mm-hmm. and let's say you get it out there and someone says, oh, this is broken. If you have that baseline, you can kind of go, well, that's all, you know, that's kind of right. was there before I even started. So you can sort of have something to go by to see, you know, am I improving it or did I make it worse, you know, sort of thing. So.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And yeah, that's one of the fun things about legacy systems is if it hasn't gotten any love in a while, as soon as you make one minor change, you now own everything that goes wrong with
right.
it. Yeah, until, yeah. Until
my favorite thing
are
like phantom features. Mm-hmm. You talk to someone who hasn't seen it in like forever. They never used it because it never quite fit their requirement. And somehow you've been linked to this guy to be like, oh, yeah, we just need to add this one checkbox. And then you add this checkbox and they're like, what happened to the other 30 checkboxes?
Right.
And you're like, I didn't delete any checkboxes. And like, and I mean, I've had it happen time and time again where someone's like, oh, this used to do this. And you go look at the source control history and you're like, it's literally been here since inception and it's never had this feature that they're talking about.
And that doesn't have to be confrontational in an argument. Yeah. You just have to figure out how to protect your time and how to discuss things in a constructive manner with all the different stakeholders. And maybe maybe you've been brought on to do some small thing and some user's approaching out of band about some other thing. You have to know how to approach that properly. So yeah, I really like all your suggestions about instrumentation because, you know, you've got bug tracking, you've got good logging, you've got some request timing. And a great thing about all that is that's an excuse to add code to source control, to do your build, to do your deploy. These are all things you have to do anyway, so you may as well do them in the lowest impact way you can. Like,
yeah,
I want to make a change without also making a change.
Deployments. You mentioned deployments. We didn't talk about
build
that.
Server too.
Yeah, like build server and deployments, like continuous integration. Like even if you don't go so far as to continuous integration where, you know, you check something in, it gets deployed to some server and then eventually maybe automatically to prod depending on the situation. Mm-hmm. At least knowing how to deploy, that can be really complicated in unfamiliar systems.
Oh,
you know, it's less complicated, I would dare to say, in the .NET world because a lot of people just use MS deploy. Or they just, you know, they go to some code provider where you're just like checking and pushing to a repo. But sometimes in Linux things, you've got like your SSHing into boxes directly and, you know, pulling in files. It's just more for a junior developer, it's a lot scarier, right?
Yeah. So doing that with just instrumentation lowers the stakes a bit. You have to get your first deploy over with sometime. Hopefully do it in a low risk environment where if your first attempt to add New Relic fails, it might not be as bad as messing up a big database migration or something.
Exactly.
I want to remind everybody, we do keep up on @clearfunction on Twitter with the #itdepends. Anybody else wants to send in some questions or episode ideas, we'd love to hear it.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, so let's think about a nightmare scenario where you are inheriting this large and unfamiliar code base, and you're the only developer in the building.
Yeah.
What do you do? Also, it's your second year as a developer.
Assume all of the prior check marks first, especially if you're the sole one. So source control, build server.
Local environment.
Some of those things, you just consider them your safety net.
Monitoring. You probably already said it, but having a monitoring system out there of some kind.
Yeah, we kind of talked about like New Relic, but that has some monitoring. But if you know that you're supposed to have so much uptime, like making sure to put like status page IO or something like that, or I forget what they're called. That may or may not be an actual one. Don't go there. but configuring something like that so that you know what the current uptime is,
right?
So that you can, you know, at least for your own sanity, prove that you have not tanked the system's uptime.
Yeah, at that point, this becomes due diligence and a little bit of self-defense.
Yep, absolutely.
If you're entering in a system that's not really well managed and instrumented, you can assume things will go wrong and some of them will blow back on you whether or not it's your fault. And not only do you have to protect yourself, but also you need to be able to give yourself some confidence. Like, here's the benchmark baseline of what we had before. Here's my change that I've tested that does not appear to have made it worse, and it actually did what it was asked to do. So, yes, I can feel somewhat confident in pushing it out.
Something that I'm just reminded of, too, we've mentioned build servers, but one of the things that will help you prove and get is a reproducible build,
mm-hmm.
you want to have confidence and reproducibility. I mean, repeatability. I feel like I'm making up words, but I don't know. But basically, when you do this again, you don't want to have something where it worked the first time and not the second time.
Yeah.
That just, any time that happens, your confidence level just tanks.
Yeah.
And then, even if everything else in the system works fine, you don't trust it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and it's going to make it hard for you to build trust with the stakeholders if
yes.
you can't be consistent about that.
When they ask you, hey, why doesn't this work? If your answer is, man, I don't know, everything's broken. Like, you know, it's, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it sounds like going into a situation where you're the lone guy, or, you know, and of course it depends on what you're running into, like if there's any, any of this infrastructure set up or not. But if there's not, I mean, I think that's the first thing. Like y'all said, you know, get a build server going, mm-hmm. get you some monitoring. You want some safety nets
yeah.
around what's there before you start diving into the code and making changes, right?
Yeah.
You kind of want to have assurance that what's there is being monitored and dealt with, and you can kind of control a little easier. Anyway.
Yeah.
How do you convince Mr. Startup that that's the first thing you should be working on?
I was
on?
Just thinking of that. Like,
because
yeah.
generally, if you're the only one there, you replace the guy who used to be the only one there, and that's usually indicative of a newer right. company or newer to tech company mm-hmm. where the IT staff has always just been one. And
yeah.
so, you know, they've been pumping out features
sure.
for who knows how long. And if this infrastructure isn't already there, how do you convince Mr. Boss, Mr. Mrs. Bossenhan to give you the time to set up?
You call it an audit trail. Mm-hmm. Most business people like the idea of an audit trail
mm-hmm.
because it's like, basically, you can come up with your own nightmare scenario. Of,
right.
Hey, if this system goes down and we have to get back to what it was before, do you want me to try to backtrack or just go back into source control and see exactly what changed?
Mm-hmm.
That's one of those where I haven't often, but I have seen pushback a few times, just like, well, I don't need it. But
yeah, source control,
you need
I always feel
it.
Like
need
I can,
it.
I can, I've always won a source control battle with someone
yeah.
because there's always, I always have a story of, I guess, where like one of my people I worked with before, their site, their FTP password was some, you know, password or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
And someone got in and literally
yeah,
just deleted
yeah,
the whole website
yeah.
and they lost everything.
Oh, gosh.
I mean, like, the FTP company couldn't help them and they
yeah,
didn't have,
it
they
it
had a
backup.
Copy of it from like 3 years ago,
right?
Is where they had
right.
to start back over and they're like, oh, no. I'm like, because it's all just classic
yeah.
ASP.
One of the things with like yeah, development is knowing your audience who you're talking to.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes you don't need to use the technical programming term. You need to use the term that will make sense to them.
You have to
right.
scare
so
them into
instead submission. Of calling it source control, call it backups.
Yeah.
Most people understand what a backup is now.
Yep.
Yeah, if you lose your backups and your hard drive explodes, you don't have anything to do except recreate it. You don't want that. So.
Okay.
You know, it's just knowing how to say things in such a way that people understand what you're saying.
Yes. Yeah. And I would even think chances are pretty good if you're coming into something that they're missing a lot of this infrastructure we're talking about. They've had problems in the past.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
like major fires.
Probably,
and you could bring up that history and go, hey, listen, we can.
They may not know that it was. You
they
know,
may not.
If you didn't have monitoring,
yeah.
you don't really
right.
know. They could have kept it hidden.
There's a lot of times where people just get used to.
Right.
Oh yeah, we have to reset this every week. Like,
mm-hmm. right.
That sounds like a bad idea.
Yeah. You didn't really hire me to spend half a day every week resetting
exactly.
your production server, did you?
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if you're on a team that's big and you're joining, you know, then some of these things are going to be different. If you're on a team and there's a lot of people. And there isn't source control, there may be some difficult
yeah.
conversations coming up.
Definitely. If you're the junior person on a 5-person team, you're not going to be able to implement all these great practices
right.
in your first week or maybe even your first year. That's going to be a lot harder to figure
Absolutely.
Out how to subtly
Absolutely.
Advocate for. But if you're immediately absorbing full responsibility for all the technical stuff, then that gives you a lot more leverage. If you
yeah.
want me to be
yeah.
responsible for this, then here's the list of ways I can
mm-hmm.
make it more reliable.
Yeah. Some source control is easy though because you know, you can set
it's
up a Git repository locally on your machine.
Right.
And you're done.
Right.
And then you know, if need be, you could go to set up a private repo on GitLab and push out there, or, you know, you don't even have to pay for a GitHub license if you don't want to yet. It's just that I can't come up with a good excuse to not have that.
Right. I mean, you might not want to push someone's code to a cloud server.
Sure.
Even
yes,
if it's
that's
private,
a separate. Yeah. Yeah.
There's no reason, like you said, you can't make a local Git repo and make backups, put it on a on a USB drive.
Right. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a little harder to convince when there's money involved. You
know,
like APM things, and you know, there's all kind. You know, ReSharper and all those sort of tools cost money.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, for most people, you know, there are community editions, a lot of these things. So, you know, definitely check those out if you're the one and only for a very small shop. Mm-hmm. A lot of times you can get a lot of these tools for free.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
If they're under certain revenue and things like that. So definitely be paying attention to that. Don't spend money on things. Don't make the business spend money on things that they don't need to spend money on, because that'll only make it your job harder.
So one more question about the nightmare scenario.
Yeah.
Disregarding all the stuff you do internally to protect yourself and instill some discipline and stability, where do you go for help if you find yourself getting stuck?
Yeah, I like to lean on communities, like your local development community, like Memphis. You know, we've got a MemTech group that a bunch of people are on Slack. You know, you've got channels for all the different languages and frameworks and IT people in Memphis who are active in the community. And so a lot of times you can, you know, go to the resident Magento expert and ask them what's going on, for instance. You can also, go to Stack Overflow and other forums like that,
are super useful.
Mm-hmm. Though the response time's a lot different, or, you know, harder to find what you're looking for sometimes. But but if you need a direct resource, I like to try to go locally and find the people that I familiar with. I see a lot of new developers do that as well here in our community. They'll come up and be like, hey, I'm new to the community, learning X, Y, and Z. And and a lot of times they'll start posting a lot of questions in those Slack channels or IRC channels, depending on what your community's got going on. And I do my best to try to help out the people who ask me things specifically. So.
Like I said, you use Twitter, you know, reach out just like now. You can find people. So if you're in open source, you can often ask people on GitHub, like issues.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of options and ways to, you know, even if you don't have a community in town,
right,
you can still reach out online. So there's lots of options there.
And you can hit us up at Twitter at @clearfunction, hashtag it depends. And I think that's it. I think we're going to wrap it up.
We'll
see you guys next time.
Thanks a lot, everybody.
All right, good to see y'all.
You've been listening to It Depends, a podcast by Clear Function. Clear Function is a group of happy engineers based in Memphis, Tennessee. We partner with visionaries to bring their ideas to life. For more information, check out our website at clearfunction.com.